your favorite source for Chicago White Sox talk, delivering news, interviews, analysis, and more. This is the Sox Machine Podcast with your hosts, Jim Margulis, James Fegan, and Josh Nelson.
Thanks, Rob, and welcome to a new episode of the Sox Machine Podcast. I'm your host, Josh Nelson, and it's Sunday night, August 17th, 2025, as we record this new show. This episode might feature the fewest minutes we've spent talking about what the White Sox have done in a series. They got swept, again, in Kansas City. They haven't won a game in Kansas City in their last 14 tries. They scored a total of 5 runs in 3 games this weekend. That's all you really need to know. So what are we going to talk about? The Savannah Bananas put on a great show at Wright Field this weekend that featured appearances from AJ Brzezinski, Mark Burley, Ozzie Guillen, and Walt Gnirko. We'll also take a look at the White Sox home run race as Lenin Sosa takes the lead. At the end, we'll take a look around Major League Baseball as the Los Angeles Dodgers provide a statement sweep of the San Diego Padres. But first, we are delighted to have a new guest join the podcast. To learn more about the White Sox new efforts in not just trying to develop better hitters, but also identify new prospects, Director of Hitting Ryan Fuller joins the Sox Machine Podcast as he sits down with James Fegan. It's a great conversation about Fuller's thought process of identifying hitting prospects, the adjustments they are working on, and gives us a glimpse into the White Sox new offensive efforts.
Hey, Ryan, the director of hitting for the White Sox, I should probably introduce. Ryan Fuller is with us. And, I approached you a little bit after the draft, like, you know, when we're all squared away, if we could kind of go through kind of what the process was for a lot of the hitters that you guys brought in. And since I'm about to go out to Arizona to watch Bridge League next week, this is really just research for me, and we'll record it and let everyone see me go about my work. But Ryan, this was, you know, your first draft with the organization. I'm assuming it's kind of the first as a director of hitting role. Just how is your process and being involved with this, kind of giving your input, you know, drilling down on, you know, amateur hitters, and how did it compare to maybe anything you've ever done before?
The draft felt really good about the process we had. So with Getsy, obviously, and then Mike Shirley too leading the charge, we did a really good job of outlining what did we want to attract in terms of the hitter skill set coming into the organization. And the org values 3 things: your ability to make good swing decisions, make contact, and then impact the baseball, with it being hitting it hard on a line. So that was the lens we looked at with all these hitters as we were going through, not just mechanics, but what skill sets are they showing at the high school circuit and the college level. Certainly with the college guys, we have more data to make decisions off of. But the goal was, let's find guys who showcase 2 above average skills. We'll be able to develop a third rather than going in one skill. Oh, man, we're going to have to really work hard. Those innate 3 skills, let's see how many we can get. And I think we did a really good job of attracting those guys into the organization. And you can see already at Bridge Camp, the guys going to Kannapolis, you're seeing higher level players going in, being able to command at bats really well. And then when they make contact, hit the ball hard. So that was the lens we kind of went into the draft with and executed really well.
I know one of the questions Josh had was about what kind of metrics you look for. And obviously you referenced like the data being a lot cleaner, at the college level, especially because you guys did invest in high school talent so much. What can, and certainly because the results of the level are going to be noisier with quality of competition, and, you know, just that being teenagers are still getting the hang of a lot of things. What are your sources of objective information, especially as you get down to the prep level of hitters?
It's incredible what is available now. Obviously, the high level guys play on the high school circuit, so they're playing at Perfect Game events, all those events where they have TrackMan going, they're collecting information on the pitch types, the velos they're facing. So we can then take that information and internally put together what we feel are the best ways of being objective about how hard they're hitting the ball, the types of pitch types they're facing, the velo they're seeing, the types of contact they're making off those pitch types. So a guy like Billy Carlson, when you look at his statistics and the metrics from the high school circuit, we saw a guy that made a lot of hard contact at the highest level amongst the guys who were first, second round talents, but also with that had one of the best walk rates on the high school circuit too. So you look at one metric we very much value is OPS. That's really closely correlated with scoring runs. So you look at the ability to get on base and then also to slug, and he shows the ability to against really quality competition on the circuit. So couple that with, okay, he's got above average bat speed too. We see the ability to make good swing decisions, make good contact. Obviously, there's things to work on with every high school player coming into pro ball, but those were some of the ways that we were able to stay objective with the subjective of what we were seeing on video and what our scouts were telling us.
With, you know, in delving kind of what the process is like, do you kind of get excited about Billy on your own and find out, yeah, the scouts love him too? How is the process kind of interwoven with, is it, do you kind of take where the team is already looking and give your feedback and breakdown, or is it, you know, you're kind of fishing on your own and then you kind of compare each other's work later in the process?
That's the beautiful part of the draft. You go in knowing, okay, we are going to pick at 10. Here is the very long list that we're going to delve through as we start the year. And certainly this process started when I got hired in November, and you're spending time looking through all of who could be available at that pick. And certainly each person comes in with their prep list of, here are my top 10 guys. And then you go into the draft and it's, okay, he got taken away. Okay, he's still available. And you're having those conversations in real time. But the homework, the work we did on the front end, certainly Billy was always at the top of that list, especially not just the offensive side, but we all know what he can do on the defensive side. And we went and worked him out at the University of Tennessee, and it was evident him taking ground balls, what a high level athlete it was. And we had the ability with Jeff Head, our director of sports performance, to take him through some workouts, get some metrics on him physically, and you saw a premium athlete. This guy is going to be really special. And then the offensive side already doing a lot of nice things. And then looking ahead to the future as he gets stronger, the development work we're going to put in can be a high level hitter too. So we were thrilled to get him.
I think, you know, his hit tool is probably what, you know, industry wide you hear the most scrutiny of, even with the contact rates being where they are. And obviously his defensive, you know, abilities and position give him a very high ceiling if it connects. But where do you see kind of the gap between like maybe present hit ability and what he projects to be, what you see the ceiling as, and how you kind of see him getting there as he gets stronger, as he gets more experience?
Let's look at it through the three skills, that lens right there. So already showcased the ability to take the walk when it was presented. He's going to see obviously better pitch shapes and types at the pro level, but feel strongly that he's going to make good swing decisions. The way we train, it's going to be a part of what he does. The other side, impact. He has above average bat speed. It's loud when he connects. He has the ability to hit low line drives, which we've already seen beautifully at bridge camp, but also when you leave a hanging breaking ball, can hit it through the pull side gap. What you alluded to with his contact ability, certainly there's some swing and miss there. He's going to see better pitch shapes here, but as he develops, as he works on a swing, which he already is in Arizona, he's going to get stronger. You see young guys when they come in, very big moves, their body isn't stable enough to be able to hold those movements. Everything will just get tighter. So those bigger moves will start to get a little bit tighter. His movements will get a little bit cleaner. And obviously when you're making good decisions, pulling the trigger on balls over the med ball that we have right behind home plate, which is the heart of the zone, he's going to make more contact. So we look forward to the development. And it was funny, you look on Twitter the last couple of days and you see Pete Alonso when he was coming into the draft, and it's just this guy where it's like, man, who would have thought it was going to be that way? So certainly when you look at Billy, there's things to work on, but swing wise, he's already way ahead of most 18-year-olds and where they're at this level.
I'm glad you said stability, because that was my thought, and like kind of watching his hand load, it seems like movements that are kind of like getting his, you know, stabilizing his body, like something that as he gets more core strength, you could see him maybe not needing to make as much of like a movement or a dropping down of his hands to load up. Is that something you can just project looking at his frame, or is what kind of the specifics of him growing where that gets cleaner and tighter, as you talked about over time?
you don't always want to say, get in the weight room, it'll clean itself up. There are things that he's already working on in Arizona to just get his body working more efficiently. And what you alluded to, making sure the hands don't get stuck back too early. As your lower body moves forward, that's when your upper body retracts and you feel the tension at the right time and be able to go. So luckily we have Motoki, our biomechanist in Arizona with him. He's already been in the lab a few times. So we get objective measurements of here's what's working, here's things that we could potentially clean up in the swing. So we're attacking it every single day, and we have the objective measurements to be able to show him, hey, you worked on this drill set. It is showing up in these things that we value, and being able to show him the stick figures of here's where you were 2 weeks ago, here's where you are now. That's good progress. How's it feeling in the game? So getting him to buy in, working on the right drills, and certainly he's going to get stronger. It's going to get tighter, but there are things that obviously we can do in the cage and we're already addressing.
With Jaden Fowski, I don't know if anyone would really blame you if Jim Thome's endorsement was enough to get him in the second round, but what about the package was very exciting for him offensively just at the outset?
We were thrilled to get Jaden. I mean, the room, obviously, not just because we have JJ Lally, he had him on the team, the White Sox scout team. We have Jim Thome in the room, obviously, coaching him, but it was aside from those relationships, one of my top guys on the list. And that certainly was felt around the room, too. But just a really mature approach, understands the strike zone, has really good hit ability already. And I see him as having really nice power potential in the future too, but certainly it's a hit tool we've already seen at bridge camp. Shooting line drives the other way when it's thrown middle away, lets the ball get deep, commands the back of the zone really well, and then in batting practice you see flashes where it's okay, let's see if you could go pull side gap, and it's really good ball flight that way too. But what impressed me with him and even Landon Hodge, obviously two guys who were going to go to LSU, they look like they've been to LSU, like physically mature kids, and you see the build, what they're going to be in a few years, and it's really exciting. But Jaden prioritizes the weight room. He's already a physical kid, and now it's getting everything to move in a way where that strength comes out as consistently as possible in the contact quality.
Like I wouldn't say he's like the reverse of Billy, but it seems a bit more like the hit tool's present, and it's about, especially if he, winds up in an outfield corner, the question around him is like, well, I think people kind of put corner outfielders in a bucket of like there needs to be above average power or it doesn't work. And obviously Jaden's going to play continue to play center field, and maybe that's where it winds up as well. But how do you see the current ability of the hit tool driving how his power kind of matures over time, and what do you kind of do to, I guess, grease the track for that process?
I love his bat path. I think that's number one. So the ability, when I talk about covering the back of the zone with the entry of your swing and being able to stay on plane through the front of the zone. So how your bat interacts through the pitch plane, and he shows the ability to go back of the zone, hit low line drives to the opposite field, but also carry that bat path really stable through the front of the zone where he can go through that pull side gap too. So that's rare for high school hitters to be able to do that. Often you'll see guys where it's just kind of like steep to the front of the zone where they'll clip balls out in front, get every now and then to the pull side, but show no coverage on breaking balls or letting the fastball get a little bit deeper and shoot balls the other way. So you see with him the ability to be a complete hitter. And as he gets stronger, he's already a physical dude. That power is going to show up when he learns, okay, when they throw a ball middle in, like that's the one I'm going to turn through rather than trying to carve a ball opposite field where they throw it. I'm going to hit it and I'm going to hit it hard. And he's already shown the ability to do that. So really excited about what's to come for Jaden.
Is that plane that you're talking about, is that kind of, can that be the difference between guys who are kind of late on something and they wind up chopping into the ground because that's where their swing path's kind of going down versus being able to, take those opposite field hits when they're there?
That's obviously it. And this is a complete hitter. Obviously, this is how you draw it up. And it's not always going to be that simple. But the guys, and you look at like an Anthony DiPino, that what we could talk about here in a second, but you look at his college numbers and it's okay, you want to throw a fastball away. I have the ability to just let it get deep, hard line drive through the opposite field gap. Okay, you want to leave a breaker up there for me? I'm going to not wait on it. I'm going to go attack it out in front. So these guys understand already. We've had presentations on it. They're training in different ways, off angles, different pitch types to learn that. So even if it's not inherent for guys like it is with Jaden, we're going to challenge that bat path and feel like your margin for error is really long versus feeling like you have to be perfectly on time to one spot.
I just talked to Hodge the other day, and he was really geeked about kind of leg kicking installed mid through his senior year. And he felt like it was keeping letting him stay back in a way that he maybe wasn't before. Were you following him long enough that you saw that switch, or how did you see that kind of affect his game? And did it maybe vault him to a level that you didn't have him before, or did you kind of see that potential in him where you kind of kept a steady view of him?
Yeah, we obviously kept a steady view of him. Really excited to get him the first pick on day two. Very athletic catcher, but the hit tool and the power potential in the future is certainly there. Him and Jaden, I see lefty hit tool and a little bit of pop there. But when he came in and he was showing the consistent leg kick, because we had seen, a smaller move with the lower half, and what I always talk about is reciprocal movements with your lower body and your upper body. If you have a really big leg kick, you don't want to have a really small load. You want those two pieces to match up well. So when he came in with a little bit bigger leg kick, I thought it matched up perfectly with the way his upper body was loading. And you saw that synchronicity and his body just working a lot better together versus when we saw a few videos, it was really small lower half and the upper body was way too dominant where the bat path got a little too steep, wasn't giving himself that margin for error. But when he got to Arizona, he looked great. We got him in the lab. We were able to see still obviously things to work on with him, but a smart kid already making a smart choice, and that's always a great sign.
Lodis, I think it's Lodis.
Lodice, yep, you're right.
Lodis. Obviously, you guys sent him out to high A right away, so I imagine you felt he was pretty polished. What impresses you about what's kind of already pretty mature in his game, and where's the kind of potential of growth? Because I think he's probably a little bit in the box of hit over power right now, but where do you see his game kind of still having room to mature as polished as it is, coming out of college?
We had him on our board for a long time, and he has two above average skills: his decision skills, patient hitter, but is aggressive when he should be over the heart of the plate. His contact skills against most pitch types, really, really sound. He has some sneaky pop too. I mean, it was over 50% hard hit rate at Georgia Tech. He had 16 home runs. What we love about him is his ability to make hard contact on a line. His 5-30 launch angle percentage was something that was really attractive to us as well. But he understands the at bat. He understands movement wise what he's trying to do. Having a conversation with him about the micro adjustments from game to game is really impressive. Understands his swing, what he's trying to do, and what he's trying to become. But with him, I think he knows it really well. He is undersized right now. It's getting to probe all the demands of the game, playing every day, being able to take this opportunity of the offseason, come to Arizona, work with us, get stronger going into next year, and being able to withstand an entire season will be a huge key for him because he does showcase the ability, good swing decisions, good contact, and now it's being able to hit the ball hard enough that it's going through the gaps.
How much, I guess, do you look at this first 2 months, right after the end of like a long season, whether it's for college players or for high school players who maybe haven't even played for a couple months before this? I think of obviously predates you, but Jacob Gonzalez like struggled a lot in his draft year, but it wound up being like what the genesis was for making some swing changes and really kind of giving a look for what he could be afterwards. So maybe sometimes this can be a window for that, but it seems like the results aren't necessarily the biggest focus from the first out of the shoot draft year. So what kind of do you look for out of like what we're going to see from this season?
The first thing when they got to Arizona was, you are now a White Sox employee. We want to onboard you with what we value here. So we had a really good week of going over everything that we value, how we train, what they can expect. And we got them into the lab like we've talked about. We got a really good blueprint of where they're at and being able to compare it in a month when they come back to Arizona and we're able to see the progress they made. But we have the objective information now to work off of, and these guys have individual drill packages that they're working with the coaches in Arizona, in Kannapolis, in Winston. And I was just with Winston with Kyle. I was just in Kannapolis with the guys there, and the coaches are attacking the plans really well. So certainly we don't want to just say, go there, we'll see how you do. We have the information to be able to tailor their work for the next couple of months to really meet them where they are and start to make progress. So looking forward to see how it is. But certainly guys go out there, it's an adjustment, especially with the draft being where it is now. The college guys hadn't played games in a couple of months for a few of them. So it's getting back into the game speed. You go to Arizona, you're waking up at 6 o'clock in the morning because it's so hot. You got to have your day start really early. Then they go to Kannapolis or Winston, and now the day's flipped again. So there is certainly an adjustment period, meeting a lot of new people, getting your face around new players. But these guys are doing a really good job and feel really strongly about the work they're putting in already.
I wanted to ask you about Botton because mostly in talking to him and hearing about him, it's like, well, I understand why they took a risk on this level of athlete without knowing a ton about his offensive game or seeing a ton of his swings. Just how do you see that athleticism both in his present game and what it maybe enables you to do after him going forward?
Really excited to get him. Obviously, later in the draft, too, premier athlete, fast, wiry, explosive dude. There's work to do with the swing. It's very steep right now. Get him on plane a little bit more, understand how his body matches up to get on plane. But when you see him click the good swings, it's a loud skill set. So seeing him defensively moving out there, it's you see that track background right there, and he's one that we're really looking forward to developing as he goes through. But another guy, when you see him and Billy out there together, you see premier athletes, and that's obviously what we want to attract.
Colby Shelton kind of had talked about a little bit, prepping for this. Like he had one college season where you see the power, and he had one college season where you see him make adjustments, make more contact. What's the process of trying to put those kind of two campaigns where you've seen both these skill sets in there, having them work in concert?
You just outlined what made him so attractive too. It's kind of Jekyll and Hyde. How do we mash those two skill sets together where there is contact and there's damage together? But just spent time with him. Strong kid. I mean, this kid is very strong. Came into our camp in AZ, was one of the best workers in the weight room, and you see that strength out there when he really connects. And evident his freshman year at Florida when he's hitting all these home runs, there's a lot of juice in there, but it's also a lot of hit ability. So now, like we've talked about with the other guys, he's shown the ability, especially last year, love his ability when two strikes, situational hitting, he shoots a low line drive oppo, but also he's going to make you pay when you challenge him middle in or you leave a hanger out there. So we talked about the positioning of his body, utilizing the grounds in an efficient manner, taking up space with his frame. And when he does that, he has the ability to do both. So he's aware of it's not an either or. It's working now to put those together to be a consistent guy, but really excited about the skills he's shown. He's going through an adjustment period here in Kannapolis that is totally normal, but his skill set's a really exciting one.
DePino put up really monster numbers in college. Clearly made and there was an effort to really get him, even despite him being a senior. It seems like his talent, given the scale that senior signings actually go for, it seems like a reflection of his talent. What he did go for, just what's kind of exciting, and is there more ceiling than maybe his age or typical draft placement would suggest?
I mean, we were thrilled to get DePino. Our analysts loved him. I certainly loved him. Our scouts loved him. So when it came time to make the pick, we were really excited to get DePino. I mean, if you just look at a performance, I mean, one of the best players in the country in almost every area that we value, whether it's wanted expected OPS, WAR, walk rate, hard hit rate. I mean, he just lit everything up. So it wasn't two out of the three skills with him. He showed the ability, swing decisions, contact, and impact. And his 90th exit velo range was very high. I think it was the 93rd percentile. So the ability to do things that we value at a high level. He showcased really consistently throughout the whole season, and really excited about what he's already bringing to Kannapolis. High level guy, asks good questions, looks at our advanced game sheet, wants to know everything that's going into it, and already has an advanced feel for his swing when things are off. But going to myself, Charlie, the hitting coach in Kannapolis, and already asking, how can I be better? So excited about what he already is and what he's going to be looking ahead.
I had a couple questions on more advanced guys before we wrap up. Just one was Caleb Bonnemer, because, in talking about the stabilization moves that Billy has, like on the other end of the scale, like Caleb has these very quiet hands. He's obviously has a lot of present strength already. And I don't know if you hear it, but something I heard from scouts is like, oh, his hands are really stiff and motionless. Like, I don't like that at the start of swing. And then they'll watch videos like, oh, he's doing a bit more to get it going than maybe I gave him credit for. And clearly it's working with what his results are, but what's kind of how do you see the path forward for that? Because it seems like he's never going to be a guy who maybe is moved like doing Gary Sheffield movements hand wise pre-pitch, but you see it kind of becoming more fluid kind of very gradually over time. Or if you probably could put the in the terms of what you were describing better than me, obviously.
Yeah, Caleb, you look at the guys that we just drafted, you can point to Caleb and say, like, this is where we want you to be your first full year when you get to the affiliate. He is one of our strongest dudes at our Arizona camps. We were able to show him lifting four plates, really strong guy. And this is what's expected. This guy is having an unbelievable year because he's taking care of his body. He's putting in work every day. But what you talked about with his swing, if you look at where he was this time last year in Arizona to where he is now, you see some pretty big changes. And he's a stiffer mover. He doesn't need to have big movements to get his stretch and be able to be really strong with his swing. But you do see the separation that we talked about when his lower body moves forward, his upper body's retracting and holding back. He's doing such a much better job versus last year, where it was kind of load everything at once and then it was everything coming together as he went forward. So already doing a really good job with that. But like any hitter, his next evolution that we talked about was, they know you're Caleb Bonnemer now. You're going to be on top 100 lists. In the future, you're going to be doing really cool things. It's not just going to be fastballs down the middle. You're going to see, especially when guys get on base and there's a base open, you're going to see a lot more breaking balls. So like any good hitter, it's you're at level one, now it's level two, and you're going to go to level three. And what can we do in training every day to prepare you for that? And rather than just fastballs, fastball, breaking ball mix, you're going to make decisions every day. You're going to understand where the pitches need to start for you to do damage. So, like any hitter, just the evolution of harder stuff coming your way, and there's not a better guy to be able to meet that challenge.
And like the more fluid he is, the more ability it gives him to be adjustable in a swing or shut down. I want to clarify like the reasons why, having a bit more movement, is helpful for him.
Yeah, when talk about like the timing of the separation, so important. So your body is going to move forward to stretch, but when you get to that launch position, when your front foot hits the ground, you don't want your hands coming with you. That's when you see guys chase breaking balls in the dirt that they want to stop on, but their body's already committed. We've seen him do a really good job of separating in a launch position. His hands are in a really strong position to be able to say no and not commit to pitches. So that, to your point, is really important, but how each guy gets there based off of how their body wants to move will certainly be different. And Caleb is one of our guys that doesn't need a big move to get to a strong spot.
Finally, we couldn't have you on here without asking about torpedo bats. It's all I spend my days talking about, seemingly with Colson and now also Edgar Caro. I think my theory is both of them, it's helped them be shorter and quicker to inner half velocity. But what kind of goes into a torpedo bat might work for this hitter, and might help, and why does it help?
Yes, let's talk torpedo bats quickly. So again, the best part about the Sox is not just in the big leagues. We have Hawkeye, obviously, in Chicago, and it's able to show us everything like a torpedo bat or a normal bat. Here is the bat, and here's the distribution of where you make the most contact on the bat. And for each guy, we have Joe Wilson and Aaron Trent, our biomechanists, they're diving into this every single week, and we're able to give reports to our guys where we have Hawkeye, double A, triple A in the big leagues. And if we see something, we bring it to them and say, hey, have you used a torpedo bat? We think it would be really helpful for you. And in the case of Colson and Edgar getting challenged inside quite a bit and having some difficulties at time, but the torpedo bat, obviously, you're moving the mass to a spot where they're making the most contact, which is going to help that exit velocity be a little bit stronger. But also, when you do that, the moment of inertia, so like the kick point of the bat where their mass is, changes the way guys are swinging at times and make it easier to turn the barrel for guys like Colson. And rather than their normal bat, where the kick point might be at the end of the bat, which causes them to be a little bit longer to where they want to get to, when that kick point drops a little closer to their hands, they're able to turn the barrel a little bit tighter to them and get to those spots. But obviously, timing goes into this, contact points go into it. But being able to have an objective measurement of here's what's happening, we have a tool to then combat it and see how it goes. Awesome.
Was 10 home runs in 18 games what you were expecting when that switch was the data pointed to
No, but man, is it fun when it works out like that.
Thanks to Ryan Fuller for joining the show, and excellent work as always by James Fegan. Now joining me on the Sox Machine podcast is Sox Machine's managing editor, Jim Margulis. And hello, Jim. We don't have to talk about what the White Sox did in Kansas City. It's not a pleasant
Yeah,
topic.
good. Good, because I didn't watch a whole lot of it. Nashville Curling Club had its annual summer Bonspiel. Bonspiel is curling word for tournament. Hosted, it's a good way to raise money. You know, 24 teams come in, raffles, games, trophies, etc. It's a good time. And so I was volunteering at that and kept an eye on the series, but the shape of the game has made me think, like, I don't need to watch this. I don't need to go back and watch it in real time. I can take your recaps for granted. I did watch the very end, or like the last three innings of, I listened to Steven Wilson give up the two-run homer, got home in time to see the eighth inning unraveling. So they got me up to speed with that. Yeah, I did watch all of Friday's game, but Sunday, yeah, I missed all of Saturday, and then Sunday was the last three innings. Like, I'm good. I had my fill.
Yeah. Yeah. Even Sox Machine. We watch the White Sox. You don't have to. Didn't watch the White Sox much this weekend because the Savannah Bananas were in town. And boy, Wright Field was rocking this weekend. Both games, Friday and Saturday, over 40,000 fans attended. And the Bananas put on a show. But Jim, I have to ask you, with the Bananas, the banana ball format's not for everyone, especially the baseball purists. But what's really cool is that the Bananas bring back local legends to the game. And for the White Sox, on Friday, they brought back A.J. Brzezinski and Mark Burley. And on Saturday, Ozzie Guillen and Paul Konerko. What do you think of the Bananas picks of the local legends for this weekend?
Pretty much as good as you could probably hope. You know, maybe Frank Thomas would be one where that would be pretty obvious, but having just played the hits with the 2005 reunion, and Thomas wasn't there either, right? He was one of the notable absences.
No.
But, you know, everybody happy to see Pierzynski, Konerko, Burley. Oh, yeah, why not run it back? And it did seem successful. I'm surprised, I guess, that, you know, I'm not surprised Pierzynski would do it just because, like, he likes being part of things. Yeah, I remember him back in his playing days. They loved doing the, like, stage wrestling stuff. Like, he's in for a show. He's in for the applause, playing to the arena. So he didn't surprise me, but I am a little bit surprised that, you know, Burley pitched, you know, and you know, he always talks about how happy he is to be done with baseball. The fact that he was able to, you know, wear a uniform and throw baseball competitively, even for just, you know, a brief amount of time, surprised me. Konerko, you know, making the trip from Scottsdale surprised me a little bit. So yeah, it was cool. And, you know, I think I'm one of those purists who doesn't quite understand it. Like, I think for me, it's probably just too much stimulation. I think just, it seems like a constant barrage of things and people and stunts. And I like to have a little bit of downtime, in between stuff. But your post, your review of Banana Ball, like the full start to finish experience versus just seeing the clips here and there and like seeing an inning at a time, and footage to try to understand it. I did have a much better comprehension of why it draws such a huge crowd and why fans have a connection with individual players who, cracked college rosters and played independent ball or maybe low-level minors, but didn't really thrive in professional baseball and have been able to find the second life. So good post by you to help me understand why it's such a draw. And also from the clips that I saw, it is a reminder that right field hasn't really sounded like that since 2021.
It's so much excitement.
And it can get loud. And it, and we it happens so infrequently that you forget just how loud it can get.
And this whole idea of like you can't get 40,000 people to Bridgeport, completely bogus. After this weekend, bogus. I mean, people were driving in from Wisconsin. You had a bunch of Brewer shirts or people wearing minor league affiliates that are based in Wisconsin, like the Beloit Sky Carp. I saw a few shirts and hats. So people were driving in from Wisconsin to take in the Savannah Bananas at Wright Field. Would they take in a White Sox playoff game? Maybe not, but you still have tons of White Sox fans in the area. You could still fill Wright Field where the location is. And I think one of the other takeaways that I had, and I'm hoping the White Sox learned some lessons here from the Bananas, because I think from heaven, Bill Veeck must be smiling every time he watches a Bananas game, because this is right up his alley. I mean, Mike Veeck and even Night Train Veeck, his grandson, with the Joliet Slammers, like they continue to try to entertain first and make it more of a fan experience first than the wins and losses on the field. I'm glad that everyone in Chicago enjoyed their time. Chicago is a very proud sports city, though. We are recording this when the Chicago Bears are doing well in a preseason game. Everyone's kind of like losing their mind right now, but they're excited. This city's proud of its teams, but there's been so much losing as of late. Everyone's just thirsty for some type of success. But here comes, I don't know, act, show, the Savannah Bananas come in and they're just focused on throwing a big party. And there's some baseball involved. And the baseball is not that bad. And they throw a great party. So props to the Savannah Bananas. I got a few text messages from White Sox employees who read my piece on SoxMachine.com. They pushed back on my criticism of the fact that I don't think they need a new stadium. They need stadium operations consultants to come in and help them out. But they do make some good points that you won't believe this, Jim. Jerry Reinsdorf approved design of a stadium for 40,000 people, but the stadium can't really support 40,000 people. And what they mean by that is if any of the concessions runs out of like a keg, if a keg gets tapped out or they have too much trash, all employees have to go through the concourse. There's no back entrance way to any of the concession stands. So if you think it's bad with the concession lines and everyone standing around in the concourse, well, the employees have to weave through there too. So that just creates even bigger of a headache. But one employee texted me, it was my two favorite days of my 12 years working with the White Sox. The banana staff was extremely nice and the vibes were just good around the ballpark all week. So very cool. I hope it happens again at Wright Field, but I'm expecting the next time the Bananas do come to Chicago, I can sense the Cubs are pretty jealous of what happened at Wright Field. I could see the Bananas next stop being at Wrigley Field, but the fact that they did this with the White Sox at Wright Field is awesome. But one last thing about the Bananas weekend, the White Sox need to change Lot B. The way that the Bananas hosted that talent show and that pregame party, we've talked about this, Jim. The White Sox need to change Lot B and Lot A. That's where they need to build a ballpark village. I'm adamant about this. They don't need to build a new stadium. They just got to do more with the parking lots that they already have.
Yeah, and that was my question about Wrigley is with the pregame staging, would they be able to do that at Wrigley? I know that they've bought a lot of the property around it and they have that
That's a good
triangle
question.
plaza. Would that be enough room to stage what the Bananas did, or do they need a big flat space to be able to accommodate people coming, families coming, and the tailgate that they staged.
I think it's called Gallagher Square, so you can set up a stage there, but you're gonna need you will need to shut down Addison, I think, in order to make that work. Like you will def I mean the, most of those roads by Wrigley Field are shut down anyways, but you would really need to shut down the roads to help the Bananas host some of their pregame stuff, or they would have to just be creative and figuring out another location. But you make a good point. If there's enough space at Wrigleyville to host the pregame activities before the
Do you
actual
know how much
game.
parking was?
Oh, it was the regular White Sox parking. So the part I got parking passes when we bought our package. So I'm not sure.
Okay.
Podcast listeners, let me know how much did you paid for parking. If it's through the White Sox, it's probably
Okay.
$30, $35.
Now I was just curious about like the family parts, given who are they drawing, people driving in, versus the Wrigley experience of trying to find parking, or taking, a lot of people take the L and such, but in terms of getting families there, and how they appeal to that, I'd be curious, whether that would be a factor as well.
I think for families that visit Chicago, they'd just be taking the L. That would just be part of the
Yeah,
experience.
could
I don't know how many
work.
people took the train to the
Yeah,
stadium.
could work. It was just thoughts in terms of, who they're drawing, and the and how much parking lot space they used.
But it was awesome. It was a lot of fun. If you didn't get a chance, you could check out my column on SoxMachine.com about the full experience. And it'd be cool if the Bananas did come back to Wrigley Field again. There's plenty of space to do it, but my expectation is the next time the Bananas come to Chicago, it'll probably be at Wrigley Field. And if that does happen, if you didn't catch the Bananas at Wrigley Field, again, I strongly recommend just experience it so you know what it's like. You've done it. Some of you will love it, some of you will not like it, but I enjoyed my time watching the Bananas. It was awesome, especially seeing Mark Burley pitch to AJ Pierzynski. That was well worth the price of admission. So for White Sox talk, again, we're ignoring what happened in Kansas City. But one of the things to pull from the Kansas City series is that Lenín Sosa hit two home runs this weekend. And now Lenín Sosa leads the White Sox in home runs with 16. Jim last week wrote who is going to lead the White Sox in home runs in 2025 and listed the candidates. And right now your top five are Lenín Sosa with 16, Andrew Benintendi second with 14, Miguel Vargas is third with 13. Luis Robert Jr. has 12. And Colson Montgomery still at 10. Jim, with Sosa now two home runs ahead of Andrew Benintendi, is Lenín Sosa going to lead the Chicago White Sox in 2025 in home runs?
He could. That's a boring answer, but I would say that, when I wrote that post, I wrote the case for and case against. And one of them about Sosa was just like his strength, in that he can hit the ball out to left. He can also hit the ball out to right. Like a guy like Miguel Vargas does not really hit opposite field homers. Luis Robert Jr. hadn't done that since recently. Benintendi needs to pull the ball in the air, mostly at right field, to get it out. So, seeing Sosa power the ball out to Kauffman, I think that showcased that particular facet of his game, which is just, kind of brute strength. And I think this series as well kind of showed that, while the White Sox are hitting more homers in the second half, still not, aside from maybe Colson, and then like Robert when he pulls the ball, still not like the strongest team. Like they, yeah, I think the second half, surge has been fueled by their home park, which, great. Yes, we've been wanting them to do that for years, to be able to, especially right field, take advantage of that right field jet stream as well as other teams do. So, like, that's cool. But when you see a big outfield like Kauffman's, and you see, they had some decent early innings to, try to spring a surprise on starters, and the ball just travels, 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 and then, goes the warning track. I think you see the limitations of maybe this fly ball approach in different places, but for the time being, if you hit the ball out at home, like at least entertains the home crowd, gives them something to watch. You're paying customers, like that's a start. And then as they evolve and try to shape a contender, you see like I guess, the limitations of that. And you see, where are the positions where we can get away with it and where are the positions that maybe we should seek out more strength, even if there is a defensive trade-off or compromise to make elsewhere on the roster. But I think that's that, at least that was my takeaway from just a big outfield and big gaps, and reminding me that Andrew Benintendi only hit five homers a few years ago when he played for the Royals because, like, he just didn't see a point in trying.
Yeah. In the last 30 games, Sosa has 7 home runs, and his OPS is 886. Actually, Sosa in his last 30 games has a pretty impressive slash line. Sosa's batting .293 with a .343 on base percentage and slugging .543. That's awesome. I mean, if Lenin Sosa could always hit like that. That's exactly the type of hitter the White Sox need. Benintendi's slowing down. He's got a .568 OPS in his last 30 games. Robert only has 2 home runs in his last 30 games. Robert is just slugging .395 during that span. Vargas has 3 home runs. His OPS is pretty good. It's .811 and a very heavy slugging carrying OPS for Colson Montgomery in his last 30 games, of course, has 10 home runs. But right now, Sosa does have the lead when it comes to the White Sox home run leaderboard. And we'll see if he is able to expand as far as this lead when the White Sox travel to Atlanta this week to face the Braves. And that is the next series for the Chicago White Sox as they travel to Atlanta. The Atlanta Braves are 56 and 68. They're fourth place in the National League East. They will not be going to the postseason this year. They really struggled out of the gate, and it's just 2025 has not been their year. Injuries, etc. But the Braves are hot. Braves have won 5 straight games. They're 8-2 in their last 10, and they're a .500 team at home this year, 30-30. And one of those players that's been red hot for the Atlanta Braves is Michael Harris. He's got an OPS over 1,100 in his last 30 games with 8 home runs. So it's been a pretty extended hot streak for Michael Harris. Your pitching problems for this series for the White Sox: Yoenis Gomez will take the ball on Monday night, 6:15 p.m. Central Time against Spencer Strider. Tuesday night, 6:15, it's Shane Smith against Bryce Elder. And then on Wednesday, you guessed it, 6:15, Aaron Civale against Hurston Waldrep, which Hurston Waldrep I wrote a lot about a couple years ago when it comes to MLB draft coverage. If you forgot who he is, University of Florida, two-seamer, splitter, sinker kind of pitcher. So maybe a lot of ground balls for the White Sox. And we'll see what they do offensively, Jim. Spencer Strider hasn't been that strong this year. Elder's got an ERA well above 5. But for the history buff, something that caught my attention while doing research for this series: Matt Olson, the Atlanta Braves first baseman, has played 744 games in a row. The last time he missed a game was back in 2019. And the top 5 all-time in the divisional era, so since 1969, Olson now ranks 5th. He is one game behind Pete Rose, which Rose at one time played 745 games in a row. Miguel Tejada got over 1,100. Steve Garvey was well over 1,000. Of course, Cal Ripken Jr. But on Tuesday, if Olson's in the lineup and starts, Jim, Olson's going to pass Pete Rose. And this is very rare. Maybe Olson's got a chance to reach 1,000 straight games, which I think is a huge accomplishment. But this is another one of those scenes from our last podcast episode when we talked about innings and how many pitchers are going to qualify for the ERA title. What Matt Olson is doing is incredibly rare, playing all these games in a row.
Yeah, and it's funny, like, his last season was a little bit disappointing. Like, his 2024 was a step back. And I remember Cal Ripken Jr. when he was posting his insane streak and posting every day, people wondered what the trade-off was and, whether it was worth it, whether it hurt the Orioles more than helped him to, like, never take a day off. Like, it was great for him. It was interesting for baseball. Like, baseball fans, I think, were captivated by it, but also, like, he tended to wear down in the second half, and the Orioles needed a Cal Ripken Jr. who is the best Cal Ripken Jr. possible. And it was more of a theoretical discussion of, if you took a breather here and there, or took a an injured list stint, just to rest a nagging injury. Like, could he have been even better than he was, and could he have given the Orioles more? And, I think it's to baseball fans' benefit, just because, like, it's just fascinating that a guy like him could play as many games consecutively. Like, it's cool that it happened. I'm glad to have witnessed it, and it's a cool niche that he's carved for himself. But, like, when you look at Olsen, like, I thought, like, last year I was looking at his, ordinary season, only slugged 457, and he plays a great defensive first base, so that buoys his value. But I thought, like, is this the toll of him, like, playing too many games? And no, he had a great second half. It was his first half that was terrible, that came out of the gates looking a bit sluggish. And, like, he's been mostly fine in terms of, like, year to year holding it together. Maybe it's a little bit different for a first baseman, less movement, less of the either less sprinting. You don't have as many dives as, like, a third baseman has, like, where you wrench your back having to hit the ground so many times. So maybe it's a case of, like, he's fine and, like, it keeps him in shape no matter what. But yeah, like, yeah, some years where second half is worse, other years where second half is better. So I think it balances out to where, like, it doesn't seem to take a toll. So yeah, that being the case, it doesn't seem like there's anything, like, selfish about it, or like that it's just chasing a number, or a kind of pride going before his ability to help the team. Like, every year he's been either an all-star or, like, a very good player that maybe hasn't gotten all-star heat. And, like, perhaps if he breaks in the league a little bit earlier, you'd be talking about him as a Hall of Famer. Right now I think he has to have, like, a pretty long decline to make up for becoming regular basically at 24, 25. Guys like Manny Machado or something like that, when you're talking about, like, future Hall of Famers, like, they're everyday regulars at 22, so they're able to build that case a little bit more. But, like, since being a regular, like, I think Olsen's kind of doing what he can to be somebody who's on the either periphery of Hall of Fame discussion, or just, like, we'll see what happens. Perhaps his athleticism, his ability to play a good defensive first base is something that'll keep him, keep him, I guess, a valuable major league contributor for longer. But yeah, it is fascinating. And if he is somehow able to get to 1,000, that's something that can maybe go on a plaque, or, like, and when people are talking about a legacy in terms of what he did besides hit homers and play good defense, because, like, a lot of first basemen in the Hall of Fame, like, well, he showed up every day for, right now this is his fourth year doing it, in, like, 5, 6 years, 7 years in a row. Like, yeah, I mean, it's definitely a signature accomplishment for him that would maybe give him that little bit extra to make more people interested in what he's doing.
Yeah, and if you don't have COVID in 2020, you have a full season. Is he already close to 1,000 at this stage? Maybe something to pay attention to. If he's able to continue this and play every game next year, would a lockout help him? Give him a little
It
bit more
helped. It helped
time to
Cal.
recover?
The
Yeah.
strike helped Cal. So.
It did. To your point, yeah, if you go to Baseball Reference and Cal Ripken's career splits page and just look at his OPS, I mean, his career, he averaged a 790 OPS in April, and then 792 in May, and then 812 in June, 819 in July, August 766, September 748. So he ramps up first 4 months, gets better each month, and then just for his career, to Jim's point, slow down a little bit. But no, it just caught my attention. One of the Braves bloggers tweeted it out as I was doing research for this upcoming series, and thought it was pretty awesome. So again, if you watch this series and Matt Olson gets to Tuesday, he's going to pass Pete Rose for the most consecutive games started and played since the divisional era. So a little bit of history for Matt Olson. We'll recap that series between the White Sox and Braves. Man, I hope it's a lot more interesting than what happened in Kansas City, but we'll do that on Thursday night for you guys. But as we always do for the Monday show, we take a look around Major League Baseball. And in our previous podcast episode, we had a special segment for that because there's Padres and Dodgers. The Padres had passed the Dodgers in the NL West standings. Jim, huge statement by the Dodgers being able to protect their home turf. They sweep the San Diego Padres and retake the lead in the National League West. That was my one big thing. A gut punch to the Padres because they had a great opportunity to, as far as extend their lead. The Brewers finally lose. They extended that winning streak to 14 games. They almost made it 15. They took the Reds back into extra innings. And the Rockies only need 7 more wins, Jim, to avoid the worst record. So those are the 3 things that caught my attention this weekend. How about you?
Yeah, the Rockies have won 3 in a row now. So, you know, barring a real faceplant.
In September, yeah, like an extreme faceplant.
Yeah, and like we saw with the White Sox, you know, their worst stretch came around the trade deadline and afterwards, like in the aftermath of it, of just we're already bad and now our best players are gone. What do we do now? And, you know, they fired their manager. Oops. And just it was, they had nothing for weeks and weeks and weeks. And I think it took until like just sheer regression and also playing like a hungover Tigers team to make it happen. Also some Angels weirdness as well, but like to, you know, try to make that last ditch effort to avoid it. And they were unsuccessful doing so. Whereas like the Rockies, like they've been basically a normal bad team since June. Like their first 2 months were awful is the reason why people wondered, would they be able to surpass the White Sox? Would the White Sox record only last 1 year? And no, I think they're showing just how special the White Sox were. And use that in a very charitable sense of just, you know, how,
what a weird way to use special.
How many things had to go wrong, the leadership, yeah. The, you know, and also I think like a sneaky part is like how unsupported Pedro Grifol went. Like, I think that's like a special recipe. And like, yeah, everybody's happy with Will Venable now. You know, we'll see how, you know, I'll be curious when you get to the end of the year, should this be, you know, this recent stretch of baseball be more prevalent over the course of the second half to where like you don't see significant improvement going from first half to second half and going into 2026. Like, I am curious whether any of the shine will wear off, but you know, he hasn't been bad. He hasn't been like, you know, I think he's been pretty honest and transparent with the media and identifying what's his fault, identifying what's his staff's fault, identifying what players could be doing better. Whereas with Grifol, everything was great or handled, you know, unless a rookie did it. And then a rookie was a disgrace to baseball. So like having seen like just how much Getz supports his front office, how much the information flow is better versus like when Grifol was there. And if Getz didn't have the ability to fire Grifol, he's like, well, I'm not going to make this like guy look good. I'm not going to give this guy a reason to hang around and give Jerry a reason not to fire him. So I'm just going to let him like just twist. And I think that was part of it. The Rockies did fire Bud Black early in the season to where like they already pulled that cord. And I think so you get some benefit of like just shaking things up for the benefit of shaking things up. And I think, you know, when you're a team as bad as the Rockies were, there probably is some benefit to just having new people in new roles just try to make anything different. So that's my biggest takeaway is that it looks like the White Sox record is safe and Getz has said like he doesn't want any team to go through it and he'll get his wish in that regard. Otherwise, like I think with the Cardinals losing 5 in a row, with the Guardians falling back down, that like these wild card races have the risk of being real boring. Right now, it's like there's a pretty big gap between the Yankees, who are getting better, and the Guardians, and even the Royals, like need to sweep the White Sox at home to get back into the periphery of the race, and they still have a while to go. Like the Reds right now are the only team within 5 games of the third wild card spot. Like the Mets are trying to make a contest of it, but like right now, the Reds are the only ones keeping modest and hoping for the Reds. Like I like the Reds in terms of, I like their young talent. I like Terry Francona. Like I'm always impressed by like the job he can do. So hoping for him. But right now, like if the Yankees resume being the Yankees of just like, we're a good team that's going to make the postseason. And, you know, the Mariners are still strong. Nobody is really making a push for that spot. And, you know, that runs the risk of being pretty dreadful for in terms of like meaningful September baseball. Like you're hoping that like, the AL West carries like the bulk of it. Cause you know, if the Dodgers reestablish their dominance in the NL West, then you're kind of looking at maybe one division race, unless the Philly, I guess the one thing with the Phillies, Zach Wheeler being out with the shoulder clot, he does a lot of heavy lifting for that staff. Like he and Christopher Sanchez, you know, I think they're built around real good starting pitching that takes the post every 5 days. And Wheeler is as durable as they come. So for him to suffer this misfortune, maybe hits them where they live and maybe gives an opening for the Mets if they're in a position to take advantage of it. But right now, like barring that kind of collapse and the Mets regressing back to what they should be, one division race and one wild card contender from outside makes September pretty boring. So here's hoping, things shake up and you get some like Brewers like hot streaks from the outside to make this more interesting than it's been.
Well, your big series for this midweek, Brewers at Cubs, that's a big one. Maybe a last-ditch effort for the Chicago Cubs in the National League Central. Astros at Tigers. So that'll be an interesting series, especially when it comes to seeding and the battle for home field advantage. Both of those teams, though, are trailing the Toronto Blue Jays in the American League. Let us know what is catching your attention around Major League Baseball in the comments section on SoxMachine.com, or you could hit us up on social media. But that will do it for this episode of the Sox Machine Podcast. Thank you guys so much for listening. If you just discovered the Sox Machine Podcast, you can subscribe to the show wherever you listen to podcasts, such as Spotify and Apple Music. You could also listen and watch our videos on our YouTube channel at youtube.com/SoxMachine. Again, follow us on social media. We're on all the platforms at Sox Machine, including Instagram. We are on Blue Sky. You can follow us at SoxMachine.com. You can follow James. He's at JR Fegan. You can follow me at SoxMachine_Josh on Blue Sky. He's JRFegan.SoxMachine.com. I am Josh.SoxMachine.com. If you enjoy our work and want full access to all of our coverage of the Chicago White Sox and Major League Baseball, sign up to become a Sox Machine subscriber at SoxMachine.com. Monthly plans start at $5, and that gets you the ad-free version of both the podcast and the website. We're going to be having a Zoom call this week, right, Jim, with some of our page, with our supporters?
Yes, we'll be sending the Zoom link out. James will be in Arizona. You normally, to what extent normally is, because we've only had two seasons so far, but both seasons where James has been a part of it, we've kind of earmarked one of his second half trips to be a minor league trip, usually, or at least last year, was to go to North Carolina to check in on Kannapolis, recent draft picks, getting into the mix, and what that means. In this case, the White Sox went so heavy with the prep picks early on, like their most notable picks, first, second, fourth, and then 11th with Matthew Boughton. Four prominent picks that they paid significant money to, all participating in the Bridge League. That why not send them there? Like, we don't know a whole lot about how the Bridge League works. We see clips here and there on social media from people who are at the backfields to see like Billy Carlson swing or Jaden Fowski, hit a double to the outfield. But in terms of, like, gameplay, development, programs, what's his introduction to pro ball like? So when we looked at the landscape of the affiliates, given that, Winston-Salem and Charlotte have backloaded their calendar to where I can see them, and I can also catch Birmingham and Huntsville as well, and I can see three affiliates. So it's like, well, if all the big draft picks are in Arizona, let's go to Arizona and see what that's all about. So James will be there, and then, like, while he's in Arizona, we'll be having a Zoom call. So I'll be sending out an email. If you're not able to make the call live, you'll be able to send questions for us to talk about in that chat, and you'll get a clip of the video later. But looking forward to seeing what he's able to just find out. His eyes and ears on the scene, learning what Bridge League life is all about. Because of the draft changes and schedule changes and minor league unionization and what that means for quality of life, housing, everything like that. That has Arizona Complex League used to run deeper into the season. But because it doesn't anymore, the draft's been pushed back. The Bridge League is this way to try to get drafted players into some semblance of professional action while there are actually no professional leagues going on. So curious to see what it's all about. James should do a good job while he's there.
Yes. And again, huge thank you to our current Sox Machine subscribers for making that trip possible. And again, if you're not, you can sign up at SoxMachine.com. The Sox Machine Podcast is a production of SoxMachine.com, your home for all things Chicago White Sox baseball and part of the Blue Wire Podcast Network. Large thanks to James Fegan talking to Ryan Fuller, but alongside Jim Margulis, I'm Josh Nelson. Thanks for listening and watching.